Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. We're here. We're doing it. It's the Gravity Commons Podcast once again. This is a listener. I don't presume that you have listened to every single episode
of
the Gravity Commons Podcast.
Oh, 100% I do.
Yes. I think it's one of the things that's wrong with you.
I make all kinds of assumptions that are unwarranted.
Exactly. But yeah. If you have listened to every single episode, this is episode, you will know, 405.
Goodness gracious.
And actually, if you have listened to every single episode of the Gravity Commons Podcast, I just can't imagine that that's anybody in the world. Wow. But please, we'll give you a free book. So email us.
Yeah.
We'll just trust you. We'll trust you. If you really have listened to every episode, we might give you a little test for like one of our lowest performing episodes and just be like, what did we say at minute 15 of this episode? Just to make sure that you're telling the truth. But if you've listened to every single episode, please email us. We'll send you a free book. Mm. podcast@gravitycommons.com. Yep. Anyway, episode 405. I don't know what accent that was.
I don't know. I don't think anybody knows.
No.
I wanted to ask you something, Ben.
Sure.
How's your testosterone?
I have no clue. I don't even know. I've never had it tested.
It's kind of a big deal right now. Have you noticed taking testosterone supplements, boosting testosterone is a big...
I don't follow the supplement conversations. I have no idea.
Well, so. I just think that, you know, there's kind of this thing now. There's like low T.
Low T.
You know?
Okay. That's a
and
thing.
Then at least all kinds of problems.
Okay.
But I'm just wondering, like, you know, I'm trying to crowdsource some information about it. I personally don't have low T.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think. Although that would explain a lot of things if I did. There's no shade here. I'm not throwing any shade. Mm-hmm. I'm just, there's a lot of, I think the standards of the male body have changed in my lifetime.
Mm.
I was watching a clip of the Joe Rogan Experience, which I don't normally do. And it was like a cut-in, and this guy was talking about how Joe Rogan has like completely transformed his body. And he's probably taking steroids, allegedly. But also like tons and tons of testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about how, like, I don't know, how the standards of what a healthy male body looks like have been transformed by our economy, by our political economy.
In what way? What do you mean by that?
Okay, here's an example. The first Wolverine movie, you know, Hugh Jackman plays Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you can Google this and find pictures of the him in publicity shots where he's got his shirt off and he's got a dad bod.
Mm-hmm.
Like what we would call a dad bod. There's no definition in his muscles. There's no six pack.
Right.
It's just like but that was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And 20 years ago, that was like strong.
Mm-hmm.
Big.
Yeah.
You know? Like Superman in the 80s.
Yeah.
Watch those movies. You know, Christopher Reeve, you know, he wasn't bristling under the spandex, you know what I'm saying? Like he was a normal-looking guy. But now the latest Wolverine, Hugh Jackman's like what, in his 50s at least, if not 60. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He is like ripped.
Yeah.
Like almost like AI body.
Right. It's completely, and I've heard people talk about this. I have heard people talk about this, like actors who have to get into that kind of shape for a movie. And they've said, like, it is completely unreasonable as a way to live. It's just completely,
right.
You can't live that way.
Right.
Like, you can train for 6 months to get into that kind of shape, but it's like completely unsustainable.
Yep.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is interesting. And I think it's, I don't know. I think it has, it's one of when I talk about like how mammon works, it's one of the ways our political economy forms and shapes and norms what we think of as common sense or just assumptions we make, precognitive assumptions we make, that forms our identity, where and how we belong, our it forms our agency, what we give our time to, what we give our attention to, what we give our affection to. And you know, I go to the gym, I work out. Before you ask, Ben,
I believe you. I believe you.
And I find that I've never had more muscle mass than I do now, but I've probably never felt more body dysphoria than I do now. And I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, you know, I'm not really prepared to talk about male body dysphoria, especially on an intro to a podcast, but we got to get moving towards, but I've just been thinking a lot about that.
Well, maybe we can do an episode about it at some point, but that's interesting. I do have to get out of here in about 30 seconds. So let's introduce our guest.
Yeah.
An interview today.
His name is Benjamin Perry, and he's a Presbyterian minister and an award-winning writer whose work has appeared in outlets like the Washington Post, Slate, Sojourners, and Bustle. He's got a degree in psychology from SUNY Geneseo, and an MDiv from Union Theological Seminary. He's worked as an organizer with the New York chapter of the Poor People's Campaign and as an editor at Time, Inc. He's appeared on MSNBC, Al Jazeera, and NY1, and is the editor of the Queer Faith Photojournalism Series. He and his spouse, Aaron Mayer, live with his best friend and brother in Maine, nurturing a small apple orchard.
Wow.
And today, we're talking to him about his book, Learning to Cry, Why Our Tears Matter. Let's get into it.
All right.
Benjamin Perry, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. We're going to jump into sadness and tears, all the stuff that makes for a fun conversation. But first, Ben, could you give us a little bit of introduction by way of just your story, your personal story, how you, you know, your upbringing spiritually, how you became a minister, and how you got interested in tears?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Matt.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, Ben.
Wrong, Ben.
I did want to say it's nice to have another Ben on the podcast.
You can tell me how you're interested in tears. I love that. Yeah, it feels weird. You know, I've been on the crying tour for the last couple of years, and it feels like by talking this much about tears, I'm really sort of inviting something into my life. So, but you know, I grew up Presbyterian in a small congregation in New York, kind of middle of the road, mainline. Folks, a more progressive congregation, but I was not a particularly religious person. I mean, my family went to church every week, so I guess that makes me more religious than perhaps, you know, people who didn't do that. But I sang in the choir, and I was very musical and was involved in church in those kinds of ways, and was involved in a lot of the mission work that our church did. But in terms of my own personal faith, it was not something that was really important to me. Until I had a sort of crisis of conscience, in my early 20s. I was working in pharmaceuticals. That was what I was studying in college, to do sort of neuropharmaceutical stuff, and had my first job working with a pediatric neurologist in conjunction with a pharmaceutical company, and got sort of dipped a few toes into the world of pharmaceutical commercial sales and things, and had this real, sort of dark night of the soul where I realized I didn't want to do any of this. And it was not what I didn't feel comfortable with the pharmaceutical industry's business model. And it violated a lot of the, you know, morals and values that I had for why I wanted to get into trying to help folks in the first place. And so I realized I didn't want to get I was all ready to go into a grad school program in pharmacology, and realized I didn't want to do that. And so I ran away to seminary to figure out what I did want to do, which when people ask me, like, should I go to seminary? Like, that's probably not the advice that I would give to somebody else. Like, maybe, you know, go backpacking. Like, it's probably a better
I just typically say, do you need to run away from your problems? Go and do you have $17,000 laying around? Go.
That's
for it.
It was a very expensive way to figure out who I was and what I wanted to do. But I was really fortunate that I went to Union in New York, and James Cone was still teaching there at the time. And I got to study with Cornel West and all these incredible folks who gave me an articulation of Christianity that actually made faith come alive for me in a way that it never had been. And all of a sudden, I got deep into queer theologies, and I found all of these things that spoke to the parts of myself that had never been talked to in the sort of middle of the road Presbyterianism that I grew up with. And all of a sudden I cared about God, and I felt committed to this vision of flourishing that I felt called to both personally and as a faith leader in ways that I had never foreseen. And so, much to my surprise, probably more than anybody else's, I got ordained and have for the last 10 years been doing different kinds of ministry. I was a pastor at a church in New York for a good number of years, a very queer congregation that got to do a lot of really beautiful queer theology there. And then for the last few years, I've been living up in Maine and doing a lot of queer theological trainings in rural congregations here around the state, and working with congregations as they sort of move and walk the journey of towards becoming open and affirming. So a very different kind of work. But it's been this really beautiful journey of finding out that the calling that God had placed on my life actually has a real purchase in communities around me, and a real hunger from folks who are looking for different kind of Christianity than what they were brought up with. And being able to speak into that cognitive dissonance for folks has been a really beautiful and life-giving ministry that I never necessarily knew that I was going to embark upon, but has been this real joy. And so that sort of dovetails with the crying work that I've been doing over the last couple of years as well. Similarly, I got into ministry without ever intending to become a minister, and I started writing a book about crying without ever intending to become a person who talks about crying professionally. The book started, I was living in New York City at the beginning of the pandemic, and right next to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. And they were, literally parking morgue trucks outside of our window because so many of my neighbors were dying that they didn't have room for them in the hospital morgue. And at the same time that this was happening, I watched Governor DeSantis and all these other merchants of death getting on the news and saying, oh, we need to get back to normal. And it was this powerful cognitive dissonance between what I was physically watching with my eyes and what I was hearing. And it keyed in for me this memory of being in my early 20s and not having cried for more than a decade and having to learn how to feel again. And I had this insight of like, oh, well, this is what we need to do collectively. That like, I went through this journey when I was a young person of learning how to feel again, learning how to cry again after years and years of so much powerful numbness, that I wish we can get into some of the reasons why I had sort of inculcated this numbness for myself. But that reawakening that brought me both, back to life personally, but also into deeper communion with the world and with other people, I was like, oh, we need to do this. And so I wrote this essay that ended up being in the Washington Post. I was originally with the Religious News Service and then made its way out into the world, like the way that those things happen. And it got this really outsized response where I had written it sort of as like I had this musing on a Monday morning and, dashed something off. But I wrote this essay that really seemed to resonate in a way that like lots of other things that I've written and felt passionately about didn't. And an editor reached out to me and said, would you be interested in writing a whole book about crying? The more I thought about it, the more I realized how much tears mapped onto all of these things I was passionate about, thinking and writing about sexuality and race and gender and power and whose tears are afforded a place of prominence and whose tears are cast aside. And, how can we take, emotional health seriously and also listen from a theological place to emotional truth as one of the ways that God is speaking to us and calling us to change.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation. where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence. And to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing. More transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Ben, you mentioned working with rural churches there in Maine who are exploring or wanting to become open and inclusive with the queer community. I wonder if you could talk a bit. I mean, a lot of our listeners come from maybe traditional denominations that aren't open and inclusive. Some of our listeners have been in churches that have transitioned to open and inclusive, and some come from open and inclusive environments. Like, I wonder if you have, like, what have you learned about helping congregations navigate that transition, like best practices, things to avoid? I don't know if you could distill it into a couple minutes.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So one of the things that I feel like people miss about this work of sort of collective change and moving is that, A, it's slow. People expect that, like, oh, you're going to say something from the pulpit, or you're going to have a Bible study, and all of a sudden, like, everyone's going to change. And that's just not the way that people work. It's not the way that, you know, faith works, especially for folks who have grown up and for years and years and years have had one understanding of the gospel. To expect that all of a sudden that's going to change overnight is wildly unrealistic. And it's not actually good ministry to expect, oh, well, I told people something once, that they must now get rid of all of the things that that they believe, and they're going to believe something different now. Like, that's not actually walking with people. That's, you know, you expecting to, by fiat, impose a different understanding of faith on them. And that's not good ministry. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's been really interesting to me is I actually have noticed that a lot of folks have this real cognitive dissonance between, that's apparently my word of the day here, but between the love that they feel for queer folks in their life, for the way that they want to embrace people in their community. I think there's a misconception a lot of times that in small communities that like queer folks are just like a big city thing, and that's very much not true. You know, here in rural Maine, you'll have folks who have, you know, they're like, well, I don't know how I feel about trans people, but like, Chris is great, you know, he lives down the road. He's a farmer. Like, I know him, and we get on really well. And so they have, you know, this tension between what they've been taught to believe the Bible says, what they've taught to believe, like God believes about queer folks, and what their heart is longing for. And so oftentimes, if you can actually walk with folks and present, you know, a different biblical interpretation, a different theological framework than the one that they grew up inheriting, people are actually really eager and excited to dig into that. But the process of that also means that you need to create space for people to ask uncomfortable questions. And so that's one of the things that I really try to do when I do trainings, when I do work with congregations. I'll say, like, for example, I'll give an example. I was working with a small coastal community here in Maine, and we met, you know, several times. And in all of them, I would start my conversations by saying, listen, I want this to feel like a safe space for you to ask any question that you have that you might not have felt comfortable asking in another place. If you word it clumsily, if you say the wrong words, if you say, like, I may say, oh, hey, actually, generally folks aren't using that word anymore. We've been using this different language, and help to do that kind of educational work, but I'm not going to get mad at you. I'm not going to call you a bigot. I'm not going to say that, you know, oh, how dare you not understand what you don't understand. Mm. And if you create that space for folks, people are actually really eager to, you know, I did a training recently, and there was a guy who was in his, you know, maybe mid late 80s. And he just asked really point blank. I'd been going into, you know, some on down the road stuff about trans inclusion and ways that churches can create policies that are more inclusive of trans folks, things like that. And he just stopped me and said, could you just give me like a really basic explanation of the difference between sex and gender? And I was like, oh, of course, absolutely. And we wound it back and we had a really nice moment where we just sort of talked about sex and gender and the way that, like, for me as a gender fluid person, that, like, I, you know, talked a little bit about my own journey. And at the end of this, you know, he came up to me and said, thank you so much. Like, I've been wanting to ask that and I didn't know who to ask. And so being able to create that space for folks where they can just bring in the questions that they may not feel safe in other places to asking, because it to them feels like the whole world sprinted ahead on a conversation that they still are really struggling with the rudimentary first steps on. And then integrating that into a broader understanding of, you know, talking about biblical stories like the Ethiopian eunuch, or you know, trans readings of Joseph, or, you know, queer you know, interpretations of, you know, like Ruth and Naomi and chosen family, like being able to offer those resources that are already present in our holy texts, and then walk with folks as they unlearn some of the things they've been told the Bible says, and really going into those texts and reading them and saying, oh, actually, like, that's not here at all. People are really excited to do this work. I think people a lot of times approach it with kind of fear and trepidation, and I don't think they need to, because people are actually hungry for more loving ways to relate to the folks who are already in their life.
Yeah, that's good. I really appreciate the patience and the care of slowing down with people who feel like the culture's run ahead of them, or the world's gone faster than they've gone, or they can't catch up, and helping them process through more rudimentary questions without shame.
And I should also say that that's like a really particular calling that, like, I feel called to, and I don't think that that's just to be like an expectation for like every queer person that, like, oh, you should like always be coming from a place of like wanting to walk with folks step by step. Like, that's not everybody's work. It is work that I feel deeply called to. And so I think for folks who feel like they have the emotional spoons to engage in it, it can be really wonderful, rewarding, fruitful engagement. But you have to understand heading in what that's going to entail. Because if you go in with the expectation of like, oh, I'm just going to make a PowerPoint presentation and everyone's going to be like, great, we love the gays now. Like, that's just not the way that anything works.
Ben, I wonder, getting back to your book, you mentioned in the first part of the book that, you know, our life starts with tears, right? So as babies, we all, that's the first thing that babies do is cry. But of course, you know, tears don't come as easily later in life as they do when we're first born. What is it about crying that makes it such a complicated thing for us?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a big part of it is that crying is inherently vulnerable, right? That to cry is to be present, not even just necessarily with another person. Like, yes, it's vulnerable to cry in front of another human being. It's also just vulnerable to admit to the self that I feel something so deeply that it's moving me to tears. To be open enough to your own emotions, to recognize what is happening within you with curiosity and with tenderness, enough that you create the space to feel that big in a world that is oftentimes so painful, so traumatizing. To be able to be present enough to your own emotional experience is a kind of vulnerability in the self that is really difficult. And I think a lot of us, you know, I can think about, you know, in this book, I tell the story of why, from the time I was, you know, maybe 11, 12 years old, all the way until my early 20s, I didn't cry at all. And a lot of it was because I was scared to look into parts of myself. Mm. I was coming into my own queerness. I was understanding that, you know, I didn't know exactly how I felt in my own body. I didn't feel masculine in the ways that I saw the other boys in my class feeling comfortable. I recognized that I was attracted to people that I was not supposed to, quote unquote, be attracted to. And all of this scared me. And I was kind of aware that if I gave it space, that there was something about tears that was going to be revelatory. Perhaps to other people, and I was scared of that, but also even to myself. I was scared of being honest enough about who I was and what I wanted and what I desired in the world that it seemed easier to just shut off all of that. And so I became really good at when a feeling started coming up, just pushing that down and extinguishing it. And the thing about that kind of process is it becomes habitual and instinctive. Yes. It may start as a conscious choice of, oh, I don't want to feel that. But you do that enough, that a suppression enough, it just becomes the way that you relate to the world. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it's very easy to move through life numb. Yeah. Bell Hooks, in her wonderful book on masculinity, the Will to Change, has this incredible quote. I probably won't get it perfectly, but she says that the first act of violence that patriarchy demands of men is not violence against women, but to kill off the emotional parts of the self.
Yes.
And that is a truth that I have lived so deeply. And it's not just one for men. Right. One of the things that was really interesting when I was doing my interviews for the book, because I obviously wanted the book to contain way more experiences of crying than I have in my own body, I was interviewing all these different folks with different social locations, different positionality about their experience crying. And what was really interesting is almost universally, I heard people have feelings of shame and anxiety associated with tears. But the reasons for that shame and anxiety were so particular and distinct. So I would talk to women who would talk about how they were fearful that crying openly would make folks see them as less qualified to lead or less capable. I would talk to, you know, Black folks who would talk about, you know, crying in predominantly white spaces. They were fearful that it would affirm people's racist caricatures of Black folks as overly demonstrative or emotional. Mm-hmm. Talk to the children of first generation immigrants who talked about how, you know, their parents, you know, had never had the kind of softness from the world that made space for their own tears. And so when they were brought up, you know, they were really intent on making their kids hard enough to survive in a world that had never been gentle to them.
Yes.
And so all of these folks, you know, had experiences that were particular and unique to them, but there were reasons for feeling uncomfortable with crying that were every bit as real and palpable as the ones that I had around masculinity and queerness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the common theme there, you know, it's not, I don't know, sometimes I think we get the impression that there's like something wrong with me, that I'm not, you know, I'm not courageous enough to be vulnerable to cry. But you're talking about these social pressures that are very real fears that people have, right? Like sometimes, you know, it can affect my career. It can, sometimes it can affect my physical safety. And so there's very strong and real reasons why we learn very quickly, very instinctively that tears are dangerous. You know what I mean? Like it's a vulnerable thing, but like when we're young, they can actually be dangerous. You know what I mean? Like because of the way our society
And what's
works.
Really interesting, for sure. And yeah, and like particularly when you're young, you know, and like I have very distinct memories of kids getting bullied because they were crying. And I think that's a pretty common experience that most people have memory of. And those memories live deep in the body, that sense of, oh, it's actually not safe to cry.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting to me is that actually I find, and research bears this out, that that feeling is largely grounded in a lie. That for the most part, when people cry, and as adults, other people feel more tenderly towards them. We see this in the psychological research. They've done huge cross-cultural studies where they've interviewed thousands and thousands of people, and they've showed them faces of somebody, you know, looking sad and somebody looking sad with tears digitally added, and almost always the face with crying elicits more sympathy, more willingness to help. We have this naturally wired empathy towards other people crying. And certainly as I have become a person who cries more openly and frequently in life, all of the fears that I had that people would be mean to me, or they would, you know, make fun of me, or they would would shame me for crying, have not borne out at all. Generally speaking, when I cry, it creates connection. When I'm crying, it often invites other people to cry. It invites other people to enter into that space with the same vulnerability. And so I think a lot of us are walking around with this feeling that, oh, if I cry, if I'm that vulnerable, it's going to invite danger, when in reality, what it tends to invite is connection.
Hmm. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. I can resonate with that a lot than I'm going to resist sharing my personal story here, but I do think that there's been a lot of pathologizing and like socially being formed out of crying that I've had to overcome in my life, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to chat with you about this book, because I need to learn how to cry. One of the things you touch on in the book is, I think, the biological or neurological impact of tears.
Yeah.
And not going into all of it, but maybe what's one or two things that you've learned about how the tears impact our body and mind that you find most interesting or compelling?
Yeah. And the first thing I like to say about the research on crying is that it's so scant. We just don't have all of the kinds of studies that I would love to have about crying, because crying is not a particularly profitable thing to research. I think it's also effeminized, and generally speaking, things that are effeminized in our culture, we treat as less deserving of serious intellectual inquiry. And so we have some tantalizing glimmers of what is happening when we cry that just we need more research into. So all the things that's sort of my prelude to say that the things that I'm about to describe are probably or likely true, but we just don't have the kind of, you know, rigorous physiological research to back them up that I would, you know, in an ideal world love to have. So crying researchers, get at it.
But get busy.
There was a landmark study in the 80s by this guy, Walter Frey, who he wrote this book, The Mystery of Tears, that was a New York Times bestseller. And his big discovery was that when he collected the tears of people who cried emotional tears at a sad movie, I think he was making them watch Brian's Song, and compared them to the same people's tears that they cried when he had them, you know, inhale the fumes from an onion being blended. So that you're comparing emotional tears to irritant tears.
Yeah.
Emotional tears are chemically distinct from the irritant tears we cry, and they have a significantly higher concentration of a number of proteins that are associated with stress.
Interesting.
It's fascinating. So his hypothesis is that actually when we cry, the brain is secreting some of these stress hormones and physically expelling them from the body, that is in fact why we feel so good after a big bout of weeping, is because we have in a chemical way concentrated some of these stress hormones and secreted them from the body, which is super interesting. Yeah. Now in the modern crying research, there's this guy, Ad Vingerhoots, who's a Dutch researcher. He's done sort of the most landmark research on crying in the last time. And he really focuses on it more from a social perspective. And so it's interesting. You have these sort of two camps. So you have like the physiology camp of like, oh, crying is actually secreting something, releasing something. It's an excretory process. And then you have Ad, who comes at it from this perspective of crying is really this social process that it brings people closer together, that we cry when we feel powerless oftentimes, because it invites the kind of human connection that allows people to transcend some of the issues that they're facing. Hmm. And what's interesting to me is like, I don't think it necessarily needs to be one or the other. I think that perhaps both might be true. Like one of the things that evolutionary psychologists suggest is that another reason why there might be a higher protein concentration in emotional tears is because it actually increases the viscosity and it slows the rate at which it falls down your cheek, making it more likely that social signal of I need assistance is going to be communicated to somebody else.
Huh. Interesting. The tears are like bigger, really more visible.
But what's really fascinating to me in all of this is just that we are hardwired in a physiological way for a connection, both with ourselves and with other people, that there is a process that all of us are gifted at birth by which, without words, we can communicate to another human being a desire for connection and for assistance, that we are wired for community. Yeah. That is a theological, tenet for me, and it motivates so much of my work, but it also like for that to be reflected in our very physiology is just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. It is beautiful.
We'll be right back.
Let's get back to the show.
You know, you talked about there about one of the things that our tears do is connect us to each other. And you also talk about transformation, that our tears are linked with transformation. And you root some of this in the scriptures in your book. And I wonder if you can pick a story, maybe one story that you talk about in the book and just share a bit about the connection between tears and transformation rooted in the scripture.
The story that I love to preach on when I talk about crying and transformation is Joseph, because there's sort of three bouts of weeping in Joseph's story, two that are physically recorded in the text and one that I'm just sort of writing in there because I'm sure it must have happened, that really are linked to these absolutely pivotal and transformative moments of Joseph's story. You know, the first moment where, you know, Joseph has been abandoned by his brothers, beaten and thrown into a well and sold into slavery. You know, these tears that Joseph must have wept as a child who, you know, wants something beautiful, desires this, this ketanat pasim, which often gets translated as a coat of many colors, but the J. Mace III, who's the co-editor of the Black Trans Prayer Book, makes this really persuasive case that actually what Joseph is asking for is a dress. That the only other time ketanat pasim is used in scripture is to describe the king's daughter's gown in the book of Samuel. And so Joseph asks his father for this beautiful dress, gets it, feels beautiful and radiant, and begins to interpret dreams, this gender expansiveness, this queer flourishing. And because of that, is treated with anger and violence by their brothers who are jealous of this person who they are growing into. And so they're beaten and left for dead. And in what's really beautiful to me is that Joseph doesn't stop dreaming. I think that there is a version of this story where that ends Joseph's prophetic dreams. But I think the fact that Joseph cries in this moment where, you know, they have been abandoned by the people who are called to love them. That is a deeply queer story. It's one that's resonant with so many folks I know who have been abandoned by their own family, abandoned by their own loved ones, who have wept those kinds of tears and said, you know what? I'm actually not going to let that person's hatred define my own future, that I am going to have a different kind of future, one that is authentic to who I am. Those kinds of tears are that first moment of transformation. Yeah. And then after that, when Joseph encounters their brothers, when they have now, you know, moved to, been taken to Egypt and have been lifted up by Pharaoh to be the person overseeing grain distribution for the entire kingdom, they have, you know, these visions and have followed them to ensure the safety of people who would otherwise have died to famine. And all of a sudden, Joseph's family shows up and Joseph recognizes them and they do not recognize Joseph. And in the Bible, we read that Joseph leaves and goes to a back room and cries. Mm-hmm. And it's in that second bout of weeping that Joseph decides to test their brothers to see if they are the same people who beat and left them for dead. And so they come back out and they, you know, tell them to go back and get Benjamin and, you know, they devise this test to see if they are actually in fact faithful. They have in fact changed. But those tears are Joseph's way of remaining open for transformation, that even though these people did unspeakable violence to me, even though they did something heinous and unforgivable, that I actually still want to be in relationship with them. And so then they go back and they bring Benjamin back. And in that moment that Joseph realizes that actually, in fact, their brothers have changed, they weep again and Benjamin embraces them and they weep together. And so it's these three bouts of crying that dot this incredible story of redemption and harm and atonement and repair. Like, crying is in a textual way linked to Joseph's commitment to remaining true to who they are and their openness to repairing relationship with people on their own terms. One of the things I love about this story is that Joseph gets to dictate every beat of the healing. That the brothers don't get to say, well, this is what it means for us to heal and repair. Mm-hmm. That Joseph cries, recognizes, I do actually want to still be in relationship, but gets to dictate the terms of that healing. And then cries in recognition that actually, in fact, they do want to make themselves known. And so they introduce themselves as Joseph. And in all of their splendor, the brothers get to see them for who they really are. Like, that is a story of transformation. And these bouts of weeping punctuate the ways that Joseph is changing.
Yeah, what I love about that reading, Ben, is how it highlights what often gets talked about is the transformation of the brothers, right? They go from wanting to kill Joseph to, you know, to embracing him. But yeah. The narration of that story is that their transformation is mutually edifying. Yeah. That even Joseph's transformation in the story is front and center, pivots around his own grief and sadness and tears, but also then is bound up in his brother's redemption.
Well, and what's so interesting to me about, you know, this reading of tears as transformative, and, you know, the way that I will oftentimes bring this story into congregations and get them to sort of read themselves into Joseph, is that I think this sense of tears being a moment for change, that they're actually not the end point. That sometimes we talk about tears like they're the end of a journey. And I think that's wrong. And I think most people instinctively in ourselves know that it's not right, that actually tears are oftentimes that midpoint, that they're the process that we are literally moving something through our bodies, and we are not the same person after a bout of weeping that we were before, that something is happening in that moment that is transformative, is something that I think that people feel is true. And it's really beautiful. I mean, when I talk to folks about crying, I oftentimes hear them describe crying in these liminal spaces, that people will cry in airports, they cry in trains, they cry in their cars. They don't necessarily cry when they're visiting a sick relative, but maybe they cry on their way home. Mm-hmm. That crying becomes this way that we actually move something through our bodies and get to a different kind of place than where we started. One of my favorite stories that sort of brings this truth to light is Dolly Parton on the podcast Dolly Parton's America, which is fabulous if you've never listened to it. Go run, sprint. She describes writing Light of a Clear Blue Morning. That she had been, you know, early in her career, she was a guest on the Porter Wagoner show. And at the time, Porter Wagoner was by far the bigger star. He was this big country music legend. He had a show where he would, bring folks on and they would sing songs with him. And he and Dolly had a number of number one hits that they had written together and performed together. And Dolly's star was rising and his was sort of waning. And so there was a moment where she decided she needed to leave the show and go solo. And so she went into Porter Wagoner's office and told him, you know, I need to go on my own. And he told her, you're never going to work in this town again. You know, this is going to be the end for you. Who do you think you are? You know, that whole shtick. And she left the office in tears and she cried on her drive home. And she said that in this process of weeping and crying and driving, the song Light of a Clear Blue Morning came to her seemingly fully formed in this bout of crying. And that when she got home, she wrote it down and she recorded it. And that was her first number one single under her own steam. This beautiful testament to, if we are open to transformation, if we are vulnerable enough to listen to what is happening inside of us, that these beautiful, radiant, transformative things can come out the other side.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned at the beginning, Ben, about your own story of feeling numb to your feelings and mm-hmm. and spending a decade or so numb to feelings. And I think most of us come by that condition, honestly, meaning we aren't looking to dehumanize ourselves.
Oh.
But usually we become numb to our feelings as some kind of preservatory or protectionistic way of getting through something difficult. And I just think as we enter into an ongoing, unrelenting, overwhelming season of things that feel too much to feel,
yeah,
right? That put our nervous systems on overload or tilt. I think we need brothers and sisters to help hold our hand and to help us learn how to feel.
Yeah.
And I think your book does that for us, and I think it's a gift in particular in this present moment. Yep. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
The book again is Learning to Cry, Why Our Tears Matter. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
It's a delight to be here.
Isn't it called Cry Baby? Why Our Tears Matter?
They changed the title between the hardcover and the paperback. They wanted a title that was going to be more attractive to sort of the self-helpy crowd.
Okay. All right.
Yes, which is curious. I like it by both titles.
Okay.
I like it in pink and in green. It's the same book, regardless of the form you pick it up in.
Okay. I just didn't want anybody to be confused. I'm glad we have all that information now.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the start recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.